And we're talking about the living universe. Do you believe it's alive? We'll check in with us a little bit later on here on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back, Dwayne Elgin with us, and you'll be with us soon enough as we talk about the living universe. What made it alive, Dwayne?
What made it alive? Is that your question?
How did that happen? Yep.
Well, George, what made the mother universe alive? I'm teasing. Let me be serious here. First, let's step back. Let's look at the universe and just begin to appreciate. This is an awesome place where we live. And for example, we now know that 96% of the known universe is invisible. 96% of the known universe is invisible. 73% is what's called dark energy that makes things expand. The other 23% is dark matter. It makes it contract. And here we are, the 4% matter, planets, stars, and all the rest is just 4%. Here we are, the 4% that's riding on top of these two titanic forces of dark matter, dark energy, and we're just a little speck on the top of these much larger forces. So 96% of the known universe is invisible. So I say to people, well, how much of yourself is invisible? And is it possible that 96% of yourself, just like the rest of the universe, is invisible? Well, what's the other 96% of yourself doing? And so then it begins to get very interesting that we're much bigger beings than we ever thought. I mean, just from a pure physics point of view. So that doesn't mean that the universe is alive, but we're just getting a sense of perspective here.
Right.
That there's something extraordinary behind the physical universe. It isn't just the physical universe. It is almost entirely what is invisible that's of interest. Now, secondly, when we look at ourselves, most people say, "Well, look, I'm just a speck in the larger scheme of things. The universe is so huge, I'm just a speck. I don't matter. I don't amount to much." But if you had a ruler and it went from the very largest to the very smallest realm, it went at the very largest, it went to all of the galaxies in the entire universe, and at the very smallest, it went down to way beneath the level of an atom to what's called the Planck's scale. And if we had that ruler, and then we put a human being up beside that ruler and said, well, where is the human? Is it way down there near the bottom, or where? And it turns out human beings are about halfway. Actually, we're a little above halfway. And in the ruler that shows the scale of the universe. And that means there's more smallness inside of us than there is bigness beyond us. And it means we're giants. We are literally giants, and we do not recognize it because there is more smallness inside of us than there is bigness beyond us. So those are just two insights. 96% invisible, and we're giants. It's reframing how we see ourselves in the universe. So you asked the question, what makes it alive?
Do we have to bring God into the equation here?
No, this is science. No. This
All right.
is science.
All right.
We can bring God into the equation. That's very interesting, actually, I think. But right now we're just doing science. And say, well, what are the qualities of a living system? Well, one thing, it better be a whole system. And in other words, my arm one place, my leg another, and so on. It needs to be a whole integrated system.
Sure.
And so the question is, well, is the universe a bunch of pieces floating about, or is it an integrated, unified whole? And as you know, George, many different studies and surveys and science have discovered non-locality, and that the universe is a unified whole. So, number one, yes, in fact, it is unified. And, like Plato said, it's a single living creature that embraces all living creatures within it, no problem. And so here we are, life within life. Secondly, the universe has an extraordinary amount of energy flowing through it. It is essentially an infinite amount of energy, according to physics, that is flowing through our universe. So we are simply sitting here. It's rather that everything, including the fabric of space and time, the seeming emptiness that we see in front of us, everything is being lifted into existence at every moment. It's being an enormous amount of flow through of energy. Thirdly, from quantum physics, we know that at the very foundations of reality, there's probabilities, not certainties, that there is freedom at the foundations of the universe. And that's one of the core foundations of quantum physics, is indeterminacy, freedom. And so that means at the foundations of reality, there is freedom, there is choice. And if something's alive, it better be have freedom of choice. And not otherwise, it's just a machine. Next, if something's alive, it better be conscious.
That's right. This
is so fascinating because up and down the cosmic spectrum, if you will, science is beginning to find consciousness. And for example, if you go to the level of an atom, the eminent physicist Freeman Dyson looked at atoms and he said, these guys are making choices. Let me read just one sentence. He says, it appears that mind, as manifested by the capacity to make choices, is to some extent inherent in every electron in the atom. So he was seeing choicefulness down there at the atomic scale. And if there's choicefulness, that implies consciousness. Now, what we find is that at every scale of the universe, there is choicefulness happening. It's both the plant kingdom, the animal kingdom, at the level of atoms and electrons, and all right on up the scale. There is consciousness, but it's a consciousness that's appropriate to the nature of the organism itself. So the next element, if the universe is alive, better have consciousness. And what we find is consciousness essentially throughout. And we can explore that much further, actually. And then lastly, if the universe is alive, it better be able to reproduce itself, because that's one of the core capacities of a living system.
That's right.
Now, cosmologists are saying, well, every black hole is essentially a big bang into another universe on the other side.
And Michio Kaku said that on the show last night.
Exactly. There you go. So this is not far off science. This is standard science. And then if you ask, well, how's it pointing? Does it point towards aliveness or deadness? And look at what we just said. We said, well, the universe is unified, non-locality. It has energy flowing throughout, an infinite amount of energy, essentially. It's freedom. It has freedom and choice at the foundations. There's consciousness everywhere we look. It has the ability to reproduce itself. And if you take those qualities, those add up to qualities of a living system. It's a unique kind of living system, but I'm saying it points in the direction that here we are. Let's not take this for granted. We are inside and part of a very subtle, very complex, and very deep living system. It's not the simple machine that we have thought it was. So this now is getting really exciting.
It really is exciting,
yeah.
Especially when you sense all these things. But you've got to bring it, you know, as we talked about the scientific end of it, there's got to be something metaphysical about it, don't you think, in order to put it all together?
Metaphysical in the sense of consciousness, like some invisible...
Well, I'm coming back to God.
You're coming back to God?
Yeah, I'm coming back
to God.
All right.
Well, yeah, I'm happy to do that because... I have spent decades wondering, how do the different religions regard the universe? How do the Muslims regard the universe? How do Hindus? How do Islamists? And on and on, Taoists, indigenous cultures.
It's all pretty similar, isn't it?
Well, that's what's amazing. That is what is amazing, is that the sages that have been the wisdom keepers for these extraordinary world religions, again and again, in very different language, but very understandably so, they talk about the universe as a regenerative, living, vital, recreative system. It isn't just sitting here, the debris left over from the Big Bang some 14 billion years ago, but it's being a regenerated system, moment by moment by moment. And in that flow, there's choicefulness, there's aliveness, there's energy. And so it's a different kind of, it's participating in the aliveness of a living system.
That is amazing.
Yeah.
And I love the theory of the black hole spitting out other universes on the other end.
It's amazing. It's just extraordinary.
That's how we get the multiverse theory.
Yeah. Yes.
How did you put all this together, personally?
I have not put it together except in awe and appreciation and gratitude. And if I feel like it's actually come together, I think I've actually fooled myself. I think the gratitude that we get a chance, we're just in terms of the overall mass of the universe, we're just a tiny bit of the mass of the overall universe. And here we have the gift to show up, to be able to look around, and to not only look out at the world, but look back and see ourselves and begin to know and reflect upon ourselves. And I think that's why we're here. It's a living and learning universe. And I think what we're doing is learning how to live in a living universe. And learning how to live in a living universe, one of the things that you do is you grow up and you take care of the earth, you take care of one another, you have a sacred regard for the universe that gave birth to you, and so on. So I think we're just in a growing process. It's very natural, I think, what's developing.
Why are we here?
We're here to learn who we are beyond our biodegradable bodies. And beyond our biodegradable bodies is the 96% or more. And that's a body of light, love, music, and knowing. And I think underneath the physical body is a deeper body, and it's a body recognized in all of the world's wisdom traditions, all of the world's religions, and it's a body recognized in physics, and it's a body of light, love, music, and knowing. Maybe physics doesn't recognize love so much, but it does recognize. For example, you probably last night spoke about string theory.
We sure did.
Okay, string theory. There's not really strings, they're just little loops of energy. And these little loops of energy vibrate, and depending upon how they vibrate, they come together into patterns. Those patterns then add up to matter. So string theorists are saying at the foundations of reality is music. It's a bunch of strings that are vibrating, and depending upon their vibration, it adds up to different kinds of material forms. Now, that's starting to sound very much like the cosmology from a couple of thousand years ago you could find in Hinduism and Islam and elsewhere, where they're talking about the great sound of nature. So basically the bottom line is both science and spirituality see and know that the universe is a body of music deep down. And every person that we meet, we recognize the resonance of who they are. We immediately feel the music of their being and the pacing of their soul and the tempo and all the rest. So we're, first of all, we're a body of music, and we can become conductors of our own orchestra, so to speak. We can bring different qualities of life into the world and into relationship and into work and so on. So we're also a body of light. Physics, different physicists have said, really, the universe is made out of frozen light. And photons are essentially the building block of the universe, and so on. The speed of light is the basic limiting factor of the material universe. Then you turn from physics over to spirituality, and they talk about enlightenment. In Quaker traditions, you see the light in people's eyes, and other traditions as well. So light is another quality beneath that of the biodegradable vehicle of the body, the physical body. So I think what we're here for, George, is to come back to your question, is we're here to discover ourselves. We're here to recognize ourselves, because when we die and the physical body goes, we're still there as a body of light, love, music, and knowing. Well, how much light did we bring into the world? How much love? How much music? How much knowing did we cultivate? We've had a lot of chances. And when we die, that's what we're left with, the residue of the light, love, music, and knowing that we brought into the world. And then we carry that on into the deeper ecology of a living universe.
Because, you know, energy does not dissipate and it's gone.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Precisely. And energy is information. It isn't just random. And so, yes, the conservation of energy is one of the most fundamental laws of the entire universe. So, yes.
How important was your work in remote viewing to all this? Did that make you even better, more tuned in?
What it did was so clarifying. It's one thing to read in a book, the universe is alive. It's another thing maybe to sit on a meditation cushion and to have a feeling of connection. However, if you're in a laboratory with instruments that are essentially lie detectors, they could care less what you think or who you are. The only thing that matters are you connected? That's all that matters. At that point, it's truth time. You're either connected or you're not. And so the laboratory experiments were very, very important in taking it from possibility and thought and grounding it into experientially validated reality again and again and again. Very important.
It sure is. It's almost critical, isn't it?
Yeah.
The lessons that you learned, the connecting of the dots.
Yeah.
Could you teach us?
Yeah. I sure can. Let's see.
Let me mention just a
little bit of background to the listeners. All of this is a long time ago. This is in the early 1970s, and for more than 20 years, I didn't speak with people about these experiments and parapsychology that were happening at the at SRI International. And I was involved part-time for nearly 3 years in these experiments. And there were four of us that were the earliest subjects in remote viewing, seeing at a distance, if you will. There were four of us. And the research was funded by NASA. It was Wernher von Braun that really wanted to know about this capacity and really for the moon landing and moonshot and such. So I had 3 years where for several days a week, two or three hours at a time, I was a paid psychic by NASA. And so I had hour after hour after hour for many years to explore this. And there were two kinds of experiments. Some were more receptive, remote viewing, it's bringing information to you. Others were more expressive, sending information, so to speak, or energy out. And what I learned from all of this, let me just mention as we go towards how much more time before the hour.
We're going to hit the break, so we'll come right back and talk a little bit more about what you learned. Coast to Coast AM. And we're with Dwayne Elgin as we talk about the living universe, and we'll be back with more in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Dwayne, we were talking about what lessons you've learned from all of this and how you put it all together. Go ahead.
Okay, great. First thing I learned, and probably the most important, is that we all have this intuitive faculty. There's nothing special about it. Everyone is wired into the universe. We're all part of a living universe. like Plato said, it's a single living creature. We're all living creatures within it. There's no one that's kept out of it. And I think one of the most important things I learned is that this is pervasive. I mean, that's just the way the thing works. It's wired that way. If it's alive, it's connected with itself through that aliveness. So, number one, it's not restricted to a gifted few. It's everywhere. 500 years ago, if I said, you know, I know how to read, I would have been looked at, wow, you must be an amazing person. You don't know how to read? Oh, that's amazing. And now we take word literacy for granted. And I think in another 100 years or so, we're going to take the literacy of consciousness for granted as just something we're all born with. So that's number one. Going along with that, number two is I learned that my being does not stop at the edge of my skin. I'm much more than my body. It's just what physics has been saying. 96% of the known universe is invisible. 96% of myself is connected out there in the universe. And so I'm much more than my physical body. Number three, it's easy to overlook a sense of connection with a larger universe. For years and years, I assumed the feelings I was, experiences I was having were simply biochemical reactions in the body. And it's only when I really, really slowed down to really bring awareness into my experience that I began to understand that, no, I really am connected, and I'm overlooking these connections. Number fourth, what I learned, and this is really important, I initially went into experiments trying to be a dominant kind of person. And that's the kind of good white male perspective, if you will. And what I learned over a period of months and then years is that domination doesn't work. If I try to take advantage of a system, it just doesn't work. And what works, though, is dancing. If I'm willing to be moved, at the same time the system I'm working with is willing to be moved, we can dance together, we can move together. And that principle, I think, applies in life. People don't like to be dominated, but if you want to dance, hey, that's a different matter. Another lesson I learned was that I became much more skeptical about channeling, about crystals, pendulums, pyramids, and other intermediaries. I think we're all gifted with the ability to tune in, connect, and we can know way more than the usual social sphere suggests. Let's see. I also learned that there is so much research going on out there that I think the burden of proof has now shifted. It's shifted from those who say, well, this doesn't exist. Now it's shifted to those, for those who say it doesn't exist, well, the burden of proof is in their court now, as far as I'm concerned. And lastly, the most important lesson that I learned was that the universe is alive. All of this would not work. It would just be utterly mysterious and remarkable. But if it's a part of a living universe, it's just the kind of neurology of that 96% that's invisible, it's connecting with itself, and then it shows up as remote viewing or some other experiment, and it's completely ordinary. It's not paranormal at all. It's completely normal. We just haven't explored that area of normality.
Do you find, Duane, with this belief system that it's made your life a little more complete?
Oh, much more. Much more relaxed, because I know that I can relax in the universe. I know the universe is not indifferent to me. The universe is present to me, but it's not interfering with me. And so I'm here with great freedom, great support, enormous patience, and I feel very much at home. And I feel like instead of an existential being encapsulated in this physical body, I can relax and know that I am a huge being. I'm a giant. 96% of myself can't even see it. I'm big. And part of that bigness is intelligence and love and light and knowing. And that's what I can bring into the world. So, yeah, it's really changed how I relate to the world and myself as well.
Good for you. Let's take a few calls here, and then we'll have more, Dwayne, next hour. Montgomery, Minnesota, we go. First-time caller. Dave's up with us. Go ahead, David.
Hi, and thanks for taking my call tonight.
Sure thing.
I had two questions, actually. One, wouldn't darkness be faster than the speed of light? And two, if our black holes are spewing stuff into another universe, wouldn't their black holes be spewing stuff into ours?
Great questions. George?
Yep.
You're the man to answer those two questions.
Yeah, we did a little study in college for a physics class, and it was just to walk a mile with a light sensor, turn on a light, and try to read it, and we kept coming up with like 1.8 milliseconds that the light would, but we started noticing as soon as the light was shut off, it would instantly go to zero. We'd do it again, and then we started getting in more on the, well, is darkness faster than light?
That's great. See, I think if you could show that the speed of darkness was faster than the speed of light, yeah, I mean, you'd be up for the Nobel Prize.
Maybe neutrinos are in darkness, you know?
I don't know. I think that's utterly fascinating. Both of those conjectures I find totally fascinating. But I don't
Well, thank you. You guys
okay.
are... It's a great show today.
You're
Thanks.
Welcome, David. Thank you. When you look at some of the things that Hubble Space Telescope has done that we can see, they look like pods that are birthing, don't they? Star systems that are ready to create new stars, they look like they're in birth pods.
Yes, I think there is a process that repeats itself at different layers of the universe, and I do think galaxies and all those star formation clusters and all the rest is a much more live, organic process than we've thought in the past. Now there's articles in Scientific American about how galaxies breathe. Think of that, galaxy breathing. And so now we're beginning to shift from mechanism to organism as we look at the universe.
Next up, we go to Genesis and Log Linda Vetta. Hey, go ahead, Genesis.
Hello, George. Hey, 2012 is coming up, and I believe it's supposed to be the age of enlightenment, right? Okay, now we got our government, and I believe they want to make it the age of enslavement for us, the people.
Well, that could be.
You know, we got that National Defense Authorization Act. You got those trails going on.
That's right.
You see what I'm saying? You got the crash of the world economies going on. I mean, we're in deep trouble politically.
We indeed are.
Economically.
Yes.
Morally. Spiritually.
Yes.
You see where I'm going with this?
Well, I'm with you. So then, how do we turn this into a positive, promising direction?
Well, I'm telling you. I really don't know. You know, it's about freedom, though. You know, life
right,
is
honest about freedom, and we have the freedom to talk. You and I can talk, and people around the world can listen, and we have the freedom to communicate. And that, to me, is what got us from just hunter gatherers to the verge of a global civilization. It's our ability to talk to one another, to listen to one another. And Jeff, you're listening, And I really respect that, and I want to hear more of what you have to say. But that's my remedy: is come on, let's open up the conversation here.
You know, his point though about all these things that are going wrong. How can you look at enlightenment with all these things when you're getting bombarded from all these different directions?
That's where these stories of Great Transition are so helpful, because every one of the stories has a time of transition, a rite of passage, a fire of initiation. And you don't go from one place to another without going through a time of transition. And we are in transition times now. We're just beginning to move into transition times. I think we're in for some hard times. we could have made choices, you know, decades ago, would have made life a lot easier. We didn't. And so I feel we're going to see a lot of breakdowns in the next 10, 20 years. And we are going to be pushed to find ourselves as an authentic human family and to create ourselves as new communities. I think there's going to be a new tribalism, if you will, where we're going to go back to the community scale and neighborhood scale. We're going to create localized economies, and that's going to be a strong, resilient foundation for a sustainable future. It's a whole other conversation. But I think he's right. This could be an era of enslavement, not only by government, but by business, but also by a big religion as well. And they're different.
Big religion could be in trouble when all this happens.
Well, so could big government. So could big business. And so then it's up to us as ordinary folks to come together and say, look, can we work together on this? And my sense is from my days growing up on the farm to onwards, yeah, we can work together on this. And we got a lot of folks standing in the way, in my estimation, of our just getting on with creating a life that works.
Well, I got to tell you, let's just watch what will happen in Russia, where this society may collapse. And under this kind of government control, let's see what happens. Let's see how they handle it.
Yeah. No, this is really interesting with Putin's election coming up. Yes.
Let's go to Dothan, Alabama. Ben, welcome to the program. Go ahead, Ben.
Hello. Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
If you'll bear with me for just a second. Going back to the 96% of the universe is made up of dark energy, I always try to keep a very open mind, especially when it comes to modern physics, because a lot of what's out there right now is theoretical, and it's based on evidence, but it's not proven. And one of the things that's foremost in that area is the dark matter. The reason that they say that exists is because looking at the spin of galaxies, the distance from the center to the outside stars, the estimated mass of the galaxies with a generous allowance for the black hole they assume is at the center, there's not enough mass in a galaxy to keep it from flinging itself apart.
Right.
So the 80% of mass that they need, they theorize that there's dark matter that we cannot currently detect in the universe.
Right.
And just throwing the thought out there, there was a science article published in a journal this week about someone that's come up with an alternate theory that maybe the universe is much more interconnected than we thought before. He got a working model. The math works on the four galaxies that they've tested so far, that the gravitational pull of surrounding galaxies on one galaxy is what helps hold them together. So the connected, how much the universe is connected is much greater than was previously thought. And they're both theories. They both might be proven wrong, and there's a third option, but I was just going to throw that out there.
Great.
Just trying to keep open discussion.
Thank you, Ben, for keeping having us keep an open mind. And I want to emphasize that the word dark, when I talk about dark energy and dark matter, dark means we can't see it. It's invisible. We don't know what it is. And if you don't know what it is, you better keep an open mind because it's not clear what's going on. So as your caution, your suggestions are well taken.
Indeed. Let's go next to Ross in Hemet, California. Hey, Ross, go ahead.
Hey, how you doing? Yeah, I just
want to
throw a little something out there that I've been researching and found out about time. I hear a lot of people talking about mathematical equations, all these calendars that they use for this, that, and the other. And as it turns out, it takes about 365 days, 5 hours, 48 minutes, and 47.8 seconds to go around the sun, which is why in 1582 we discovered we had to have a leap year. It wasn't until about, 45 B.C. that Julius Caesar put that 30-day, 12-month calendar into use. So from all the time before that and up until the year 1582, we haven't been accounting for these extra times, which means that our dates and all the dates around the world are wrong.
How wrong are we off by?
Well, it's hard to say because for many, many years, they didn't really keep any dates. Like I said, it wasn't until Julius Caesar time that he actually put a 30-month, 12-month period into effect and started using that kind of a calendar. So for time before that, and for a long time, they never kept much track of time. So it's hard to really pinpoint it down, but we're talking thousands and thousands of years of, you know, every so often we have to do the leap year, the extra 10 days that we add. So I would suspect we're off by maybe hundreds, if not thousands of years.
Well, all right. That may be. You never know. Interesting observation there, Dwayne.
Yep. It's beyond my, it's outside my.
You're not a Mayan who is an expert in calendars, right?
No, I'm not. No.
What's your next work? What are you working on next? What are you doing?
Let's see. I'm really passionate, George, about two things. Change the story to change the world. We need new stories. The American dream is becoming the world's nightmare with climate change and species extinction and all the rest. And the Americans are most creative, innovative people. And instead of a dream, we need a wide awake vision. Come on, let's talk. Let's create a wide awake vision for a promising future. So I am passionate about us coming together in conversation to consciously create a future for ourselves as a country. So one part of that is the message. And that comes from all of us. And the other part is the message machine, and that is the mass media. And so I think it's time to take back the airways for a new level of mature social conversation.
Well, that would be the best thing to happen. It sure would.
Yeah.
Do other scientists jump on board? Do they believe the universe is alive?
Well, I would say, you know, as good scientists, they have to maintain more of an agnostic point of view. Say, well, I'm just not sure. Personally, I can offer my point of view, but professionally, I have to take position that this has not been established one way or the other. I have given presentations in scientific settings where maybe a quarter of the out of a room full of 100, 200 scientists, a quarter walked out when I started talking about a living universe. They just walked out. And other scientists then stood up in the audience and they were defending the premises underlying the idea of a living universe. And so they were saying, no, this is good science. This works. This is right on. So we are at a turning point in science itself. Because if science regards the universe as a living system, that is going to profoundly change the conduct of science and then the conduct of life.
All right. Well, that may work. Well, stay with us. We're going to come back for a final hour of phone calls with Dwayne Elgin right here on Coast to Coast AM. So jump aboard. We will be back.